From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Let me be clear. I am not a terrorist. I am not a member of Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist group. I am a father, a husband, and an engineer. I am also a victim of the immoral practice of extraordinary rendition.
Maher Arar was kidnapped by the U.S. government from Kennedy Airport in New York and sent to Syria, where he was tortured. He testified before Congress from Canada this past week because he remains on a terrorist no-fly list. We'll speak with Democratic Congress member Gerald Nadler, who's calling for the U.S. to apologize, and with Arar's attorney, David Cole. But first, the Bush administration suffers a major setback after a mistrial is declared in the Holy Land terrorism financing case. And as tensions remain high along the Turkish-Iraqi border, we'll be joined by a Kurdish human rights activist here in our Firehouse studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fires continue to rage for a fourth day in Southern California. The flames have engulfed 585 square miles and forced upwards of 500,000 people from their homes. More than 1,000 buildings have been destroyed so far. At least 5 people have been killed, more than 36 injured. 10,000 evacuees have taken refuge at the emergency shelter at San Diego's Pro Football Stadium. This is California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I think that the coordination between the locals, the state, and the federal government is very important. This is a really fast-moving fire, and it has really been disastrous for so many people. And we want to make sure there's enough manpower and enough equipment and resources available for the firefighters.
Today's forecast calls for higher winds and soaring temperatures for the affected areas. President Bush has declared a federal emergency ahead of a visit to the region tomorrow. A top California official has criticized President Bush's visit and called on him to order California National Guard out of Iraq to help out in their home state. Speaking on MSNBC, California Lieutenant Governor John Garamondi said Bush's visit would distract from the relief effort. He said, quote, "What we really need are those firefighters. We need the equipment. We need, frankly, we need our troops back from Iraq." His comments come as California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer said the California National Guard is operating with just half the equipment it needs because of the war in Iraq. In Iraq, at least 6 civilians are among as many as 14 dead in a U.S. airstrike north of Baghdad. This is an unidentified resident.
Farmers were watering plants when planes attacked them. A wounded man was brought to the house and a large group of people gathered to see. There were a number of people and I was one of them. When the Americans fired a missile on us, I was standing outside the house. 12 or 13 people were killed and 9 others were wounded.
The deaths follow 2 other lethal U.S. attacks on Iraqi civilians this month. At least 13 civilians, including 2 toddlers, died in a U.S. raid on Sadr City this weekend. And earlier this month, at least 9 children and 6 women were killed in a U.S. attack northwest of Baghdad. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has approved new rules governing private military contractors that fail to provide any legal framework for holding them accountable for their actions in Iraq. The rules were proposed by a panel formed in the wake of last month's killing of 17 Iraqi civilians by Blackwater Guards in Baghdad. The panel concluded there is no alternative to the reliance on private contractors to guard U.S. officials. Neither the U.S. military nor the State Department's Diplomatic Security Service are prepared to take responsibility. The panel says it found no legal precedent for subjecting contractors to legal jurisdiction and urged the Bush administration to take up the issue. Other new measures include mandatory cultural sensitivity training for private contractors and the formation of new panels based out of the U.S. Embassy to investigate violent incidents. The Washington Post reports the rules appear to reject Pentagon calls to put the contractors under military control. The news comes as the Bush administration has admitted State Department contracts to private security contractors have quadrupled to nearly $4 billion per year. The rise in payments has not been accompanied by an increase in oversight. A According to the New York Times, administration officials admit they've hired few new officials to monitor the contracts. There are currently only 17 contract compliance officers overseeing the billions of dollars in contracts to companies like Blackwater and DynCorp. In addition to work in Iraq and Afghanistan, the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs has doled out more than $2.2 billion for police training and drug eradication abroad. 94% of that money has gone to DynCorp. Meanwhile, a new estimate says the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan could cost upwards of $2.4 trillion over the next decade. The Congressional Budget Office says the figure takes into account more than $700 billion in interest since the wars are being funded with borrowed money. The total amounts to nearly $8,000 for every U.S. resident. The Iraq War accounts for roughly 80% at $1.9 trillion. In the lead-up to the Iraq War 4 years ago, the Bush administration estimated the invasion could cost no more than $50 billion. The Bush administration continues to push its plan for a missile system in Eastern Europe. On Tuesday, President Bush said the system is needed as protection against a possible Iranian attack.
The need for missile defense in Europe is real, and I believe it's urgent. Iran is pursuing the technology that could be used to produce nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles of increasing range that could deliver them. Last November, Iran conducted military exercises in which it launched ballistic missiles capable of striking Israel and Turkey, as well as American troops based in the Persian Gulf.
Critics say the missile system would give the Bush administration a first-strike option in a key strategic area. The Bush administration wants to host the system in Poland and the Czech Republic over a majority public opposition in both countries. The Bush administration is being accused of severely editing the congressional testimony by a senior health official on the impact of climate change. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Julie Gerberding appeared before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee Tuesday. The Associated Press reports two sources familiar with both her initial draft and the White House's revisions say the administration imposed major changes. Gerberding's final testimony is said to have omitted lengthy passages she had initially included on the health risks of global warming. Her final document was whittled down to 4 pages from an original 14. An anonymous CDC official said the White House eviscerated the testimony. The White House had no comment. Democratic senators are calling for the release of Gerberding's full, unedited statement. The censorship comes days after President Bush's top science advisor and increased global warming has no effect on natural disasters. White House Office of Science and Technology Policy Director John Marburger was explaining his dismissal of the widely shared target of preventing the Earth's temperature from rising more than 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. He said, quote, "The goal is going to be a very difficult one to achieve and is not actually linked to regional events that affect people's lives." In other news from Washington, a Republican lawmaker called for the arrest of 3 college students Tuesday to prevent them from appearing at a news conference on Capitol Hill. The students are all children of undocumented workers who've been in the U.S. for more than a decade. They were speaking out in support of passage of the Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors Act. The DREAM Act would grant permanent citizenship to undocumented workers' children if they completed 2 years of college, trade school, or military service. But before the press conference, Congressmember Tom Tancredo of Colorado said the students should be arrested. He said, quote, "Just because these illegal aliens are being used for political gain doesn't mean they get immunity from the law." The press conference was initially postponed but went ahead with no arrests. In other congressional news, Democratic Congressmember Pete Stark of California has apologized for controversial remarks last week on the House floor. Stark made the comments during debate over President Bush's veto of an expansion to child's health insurance. He said, quote, "You don't have money to fund the war or children, but you're going to spend it to blow up innocent people if we can get enough kids to grow old enough for you to send to Iraq to get their heads blown off for the president's amusement." A Republican measure to censure Stark fell short Tuesday on the House floor. Stark initially refused to apologize, but finally backed down under pressure from Democratic leaders. Stark says he apologized in part to focus attention on the issues, not on his comments. And President Bush is expected to announce his new measures today, intensifying the U.S. economic and diplomatic isolation of Cuba. Advisors say Bush will announce the U.S. will not accept a political transition in which President Fidel Castro hands off authority to his brother Raul. Raul Castro has served as acting Cuban president since Fidel Castro stepped down to undergo medical treatment last year. President Bush is expected to encourage Cuban military and police to work against the Cuban government, telling them, quote, there's a place for you in a new Cuba. He's also expected to unveil plans for a so-called freedom fund that Cuba would receive under different leadership. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A mistrial was declared Monday in the Bush administration's largest terrorism financing case. The government had accused the now-defunct Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development of providing, quote, material support to a terrorist organization. But jurors failed to reach a unanimous verdict, and the U.S. district judge declared a mistrial on most of the charges in the federal case against the Holy Land Foundation and five of its former leaders. The Texas-based Holy Land Foundation was once the largest Muslim charity in the United States. It collected donations for local committees providing humanitarian aid in the West Bank and Gaza. But the U.S. government claimed the committees were controlled by Hamas, which has been designated a terrorist organization since 1995. The case against Holy Land Foundation relied on Israeli intelligence and disputed documents and electronic surveillance gathered by the FBI over a span of 15 years. However, one juror told the Los Angeles Times the government case had, quote, so many gaps, the prosecution was, quote, a waste of time. This case is one of numerous material support prosecutions. Hina Shamsi, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project, said the material support statute, quote, criminalizes guilt by association and can be used to prosecute innocent donors. David Cole is a professor of law at Georgetown University, the co-author of Less Safe, Less Free, Why America's Losing the War on Terror. He joins us from Capitol Hill. Welcome to Democracy Now!, David.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Explain exactly what happened in this case. Begin from the beginning. When was the Holy Land Foundation shut down?
Well, it was nearly 6 years ago, in December 2001. All their assets were frozen. All of their records were seized. The entity was shut down without a hearing, without a trial, without even a statement of reasons. And when the group sought to challenge that designation and that freezing in court, the court refused to allow the Holy Land Foundation to introduce evidence in its own defense. It relied on secret evidence that the government presented to it behind closed doors so that the foundation couldn't respond, and rejected its arguments that this whole process violated due process by depriving it of its property without any meaningful opportunity to defend itself.
What exactly have you come to understand now at this point was the evidence, the secret evidence, both U.S. and Israeli?
Well, it was U.S. and Israeli, and it was gathered, as you suggested, over a course of 15 years. But what's most remarkable is that even though they subjected this group to 15 years of surveillance, they found not one piece of evidence that showed that this group was funding Hamas itself during the period since 1995 when it was illegal to fund Hamas. And instead, the argument that they made in court was it's not that you funded Hamas, but you funded these Zakat committees. You should have known that these humanitarian aid, local Zakat committees in Ramallah and Hebron, et cetera, were in fact fronts for or otherwise associated with Hamas. But the government has the power to designate as terrorist any front or affiliate or associate of Hamas, and it hasn't ever, to this day, designated any of these committees. So the government's basically saying you should be put in jail, not for funding a group that we put on a blacklist, Hamas, but for funding groups that we chose not to put on a blacklist, but you should have known that they would have been on the blacklist anyway. It's a real stretch, and I think that's why the jury did not reach a single guilty conviction on 197 counts.
Now, it was against the Holy Land Foundation, but also individually its heads. Who are they?
That's right. It's five members of the board and employees of the foundation who did the work of the organization over the course of its existence. And one of the five was acquitted on all charges but one. Two others, the jury initially said that they were acquitted as well, but when the judge polled the jury, two jurors said, well, that's not my vote, and they went back in and they came out, and in fact, they couldn't reach unanimity. So at the end of the day, no convictions for the government. I think, you know, the real lesson here is 6 years ago, we had a conviction in a totally one-sided proceeding, you know, where the Holy Land didn't have any opportunity to defend itself and the government didn't have to put its evidence on the table. Now, the government has to put its evidence on the table. Holy Land has the opportunity to defend itself. And a jury of American citizens refuses to find, you know, them guilty in any respect. And I think that suggests that this initial process by which the government can unilaterally shut down charities without any real process, real hearing, needs to be revised.
We're talking to David Cole. He is a professor of law at Georgetown University, speaking to us from the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. We are also joined on the telephone from Louisville, Texas, by Khalil Meek. He's the president of the Muslim Legal Fund of America, the spokesperson of Hungry for Justice, a national coalition of civil rights groups supporting a fair trial for the Holy Land Foundation. Khalil Meek, thank you for joining us. Your reaction to the mistrial?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Your reaction to the mistrial.
Oh, a reaction to the mistrial? Well, we still, as a Muslim community, consider this a huge victory. I mean, we're happy, relieved. We think the truth came out or is still coming out. But we think it was a win for the American people, the jury system, due process. Because like David said, what we had here was a case, you know, built on 13 years of investigation and wiretapping, surveillance, the largest terrorism case in history, coordination with other security agencies, millions and, you know, millions and millions of dollars spent, over 3 months in a courtroom, the largest deliberation in Texas history, almost 200 indictments, and the jury said not one guilty verdict, no conviction, and that there were more fear over facts or evidence than any of the counts.
Khalil Meek, how has the Holy Land Foundation case, the closing of it more than 6 years ago, the terrorism charges, affected the ability of Muslims in this country to give charity?
Well, I think it's dramatically affected the ability to give charity to Palestinians. I think this is a very specific political process that has really damaged the Palestinians. All the charities that were given to Palestine have either been shut down or under extreme scrutiny, and it is so difficult to provide aid in that area of the region that it's affected it dramatically. I'm not sure that it's affected all other areas of charity and all other charitable outlets, but it has had a dramatic effect in that area.
David Cole, can the government retry this case?
Well, they can, and they've said that they will. A mistrial is just that, a mistrial. You start over. But it's not as if the government's going to have any better evidence the next time around. They had 13 years to prepare the case. It's not like the second time around they're going to do a whole heck of a lot better. It's extremely expensive, and I think there'll be significant incentives for the government to try to reach some sort of settlement on some kind of safe, face-saving, minor guilty plea. But they may well try it again, and then we'll see. I mean, you know, I think what we ought to take away from this is that this is, number one, a very, very troubling statute. It is essentially a guilt by association statute. No matter what your intent, no matter what kind of aid you provide to a designated group, you are treated as a criminal terrorist under the statute. But this case shows that the government's not even satisfied with that guilt by association theory, and instead it wants to go further and hold people responsible for groups that have not been for supporting groups that have not been designated. Again, the Zakat committees have not been designated to this day, and yet the government wants to hold these people criminally liable, put them in jail for supporting a group that the government never said you couldn't support. That's truly a scary proposition and will have a tremendous chilling effect throughout the charitable communities.
David Cole, you wrote a piece in The Washington Post today, an op-ed piece called Anti-Terrorism on Trial, Why the Government Loses Funding Cases. And you say this failure isn't the government's first. You talk about 2005, the Tampa jury acquitting Sami Alarian, the University of South Florida professor, of the most serious counts against him involving alleged fundraising for Palestinian Islamic Jihad. You also talk about a Chicago case. Can you elaborate on these? Sami Alarian remains in prison.
Sami Alarian remains in prison, although through shenanigans of the government, not by virtue of that particular case, where, again, they had a multi-year investigation, thousands of hours of wiretaps, a six-month trial. They put on 80 witnesses. Professor Alarian didn't put on a single witness in his defense because he felt that the case the government made was so weak. And the jury acquitted him on all the most serious charges and voted 10-2 to acquit him on a handful of other charges. And he ultimately pled guilty to a minor charge and eventually will be allowed to leave the country. And then in Chicago, this year, a jury acquitted two Palestinians of allegedly, again, supporting Hamas. Again, after a lengthy investigation, and again, the government sought to push the envelope. These people were alleged to have supported Hamas before it was illegal to support Hamas, that is, before 1995. But the government's theory was, well, we're going to treat Hamas as a RICO enterprise, as essentially like the mob, and any support to it constitutes a RICO crime. The jury, again, acquitted. And then, of course, you have the Saudi student in Idaho who was charged with providing material support to a terrorist organization by putting up links on a website to other websites that had jihadist content on them. All of these, I think, show that the government is really pushing the envelope in the name of preventing terrorism and going after people where it doesn't really have the goods, where it really doesn't have evidence that they've committed crimes. And it's trying instead to expand the definition of the crime to hold people responsible, not for what they have done, but for what we fear based on speculation they might do in the future. And I think the jury system has, fortunately, in these cases, worked. The juries have been much more faithful to the First Amendment and to the principles that this country stands for at its best than has the Justice Department.
Halil Meek, how much interest and attention is being paid by the Muslim community in this country to the Holy Land Foundation case?
Well, I think it was a very galvanizing case for the Muslim community. Almost every Muslim in America was affected by this case, or could have been, because the government decided to make it really a dragnet for all the Muslim organizations. They listed over 300 individuals and organizations as unindicted co-conspirators in this case, so that if they got a guilty verdict, you would have our largest charity convicted of something with terrorism, and the largest advocacy groups, the largest educational groups, the largest holding companies. So everything in America was put on trial in the Holy Land Foundation case. And so I think it galvanized the Muslim community. I think everybody had something at stake in this. And we think that this is, you know, a process of, I don't know, maybe like summarize what David said, it's a fishing expedition. I mean, they're not putting crimes on trial here. The Holy Land Foundation is not even accused of any violent act or destruction of property, harming anyone. They're accused of feeding, clothing, sheltering, you know, educating, providing medical assistance to Palestinian women and children. And somehow that becomes criminal.
Halil Meek, I want to thank you for being with us, president of the Muslim Legal Fund of America. Also, David Cole, our guest, professor of law at Georgetown University. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
وانا وياك وانا شايفك هنا بعيني بعيش.
Music by Amr Diop here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A group of Democratic and Republican members of Congress have personally apologized to Maher Arar. He's the Canadian citizen who was seized by U.S. officials in 2002 at JFK Airport here in New York and secretly flown to Syria as part of the Bush administration's so-called Extraordinary Rendition Program. In Syria, Arar was held for more than 10 months in a grave-like cell. He was tortured and interrogated. He was released without ever being charged with a crime. On Thursday, Maher Arar testified before a House Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Subcommittee hearing on extraordinary rendition. It marked the first time Arar had a chance to tell a story to U.S. lawmakers, but he couldn't testify before Congress in person. Even though the Canadian government has cleared his name, Arar remains barred from entering the United States because the Bush administration maintains he poses a national security threat. He's on a no-fly terrorist list. In a moment, we'll play Maher Arar's testimony and be joined by Democratic Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York. But first, I want to go back to David Cole, the law professor at Georgetown University, who's co-counsel for Maher Arar. Welcome to Democracy Now!, David Cole.
Thanks, Amy.
I wanted to ask you about the case overall and the significance of Maher Arar testifying.
Well, I think this was huge. I mean, we would have, of course, liked him to be able to testify in person, but the United States government is still keeping him out of this country. You know, he went back to Canada. Canada investigated his case with a commission headed up by a Supreme Court justice. They issued a 1,000-page report. They fully exonerated Mr. Arar. They apologized. They paid him damages. And yet the United States still won't even let him come into the country, even though it's been established that the only basis they had for sending him to Syria at all was Canada's misinformation that Canada provided him. We won't let him in the country. We won't apologize. And in the case that we've brought against him, the government argues, number one, that he has no rights whatsoever because he's not an American, he's a Canadian, and number two, that the whole process of rendering him to Syria is a state secret, and therefore the courts can't adjudicate the matter, even if it was a violation of fundamental human rights and constitutional freedom.
David Cole, I wanted to ask you about a piece that appeared in the Toronto Globe and Mail on Saturday. I was in Canada this weekend and picked it up. It was just 2 days after Maher Arar testified before Congress. The article called Why U.S. Won't Remove Arar from No-Fly List. And the article said, Maher Arar's denials that he ever went to Afghanistan are contradicted by a man convicted of immigration fraud and a self-confessed Mujahideen instructor who says he spotted him there in the early 90s, according to classified American documents seen by the Globe and Mail. The intelligence documents are said by U.S. sources to be key to understanding Washington's argument that even though Mr. Arar has been cleared of any wrongdoing and paid $10 million in compensation by the Canadian government, he should remain on a no-fly list and remain barred from entering U.S. territory as an alleged security threat. Until now, the files have been accessible only to those with security clearance and appear to be the invisible hurdle as Mr. Arar fights to clear his name in the United States. Again, this based on man who has been imprisoned in Minneapolis, according to his statements. Maher Arar said the only thing he knows about him is that he once brought his car to be fixed by his brother in Montreal. Your response, David Cole?
Well, I mean, here you've got a guy who has been convicted of fraud, sitting in jail for lying. And he says, well, I think I remember spotting Mr. Arar in Afghanistan more than 10 years ago. How reliable is that? Mr. Arar has said point blank he's never been to Afghanistan, period. The Canadians spent months and months investigating this case. They fully exonerated him, found that there was no evidence whatsoever. The Canadians even came to the United States and looked at the classified evidence that the government had regarding Mr. Arar, and they came away saying, this doesn't change our opinion in one way at all. We find that there's no basis for believing that he's engaged in any wrongdoing and that he poses any danger to anybody. So, I think the government is sort of reaching to try to justify a completely unjustifiable act. And, the bottom line, of course, is no matter what, even if Mr. Arar were not innocent, it turns out he is a totally innocent person, but even if he weren't a totally innocent person, you don't send somebody to Syria to be tortured, period. That's the end of story. So I think the government's trying to pull at, very weak reeds to justify an unjustifiable act.
David Cole, I want to thank you very much for being with us. David Cole, law professor at Georgetown University, co-author of the book Less Safe, Less Free. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. In a moment, we'll be joined by Democratic Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York. But first, we're going to turn to Maher Arar himself. Well, his testimony last week before Congress. He spoke via video conference because he's still barred from entering the United States.
Let me be clear. I am not a terrorist. I am not a member of Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist group. I'm here today to tell you about what happened to me and how I was detained and interrogated by the United States government, transported to Syria against my will, tortured, and kept there for a year. Upon viewing my valid Canadian passport, an immigration officer pulled me aside. Officers from the FBI and the New York Police Department arrived and began to interrogate me. My repeated requests for a lawyer were all denied. I was told that I had no right to a lawyer because I was not an American citizen. I was then taken to the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, where I was kept for the next 10 days. After 5 days of repeated requests, I was finally allowed to make a brief phone call to alert my family of my whereabouts. On October 8th, at 3 in the morning, I was awakened and told that they had decided to remove me to Syria. By then, it was becoming more and more clear to me that I was being sent to Syria for the purpose of being tortured. There, I was put in a dark underground cell that was more like a grave. It was 3 feet wide, 6 feet deep, and 7 feet high. Life in that cell was hell. I spent 10 months and 10 days in that grave. During the early days of my detention, I was interrogated and physically tortured. I was beaten with an electrical cable and threatened with a metal chair, the tire, and electric shocks. I was forced to falsely confess that I had been to Afghanistan. When I was not being beaten, I was put in a waiting room so that I could hear the screams of other prisoners. The cries of the women still haunt me the most. After 374 days of torture and wrongful detention, I was finally released to Canadian embassy officials on October 5th, 2003. This past few years have been a nightmare for me. Since my return to Canada, my physical pain has slowly healed, but the cognitive and psychological scars from my ordeal remain with me on a daily basis. I still have nightmares and recurring flashbacks. I am not the same person that I was. I also hope to convey how fragile our human rights have become, and how easily they can be taken from us by the same governments that have sworn to protect them.
Maher Arar testifying last week by video conference before a congressional hearing. Democratic Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York joins us now from Capitol Hill. He's the chair of the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Congressmember Nadler, your response to Maher Arar's testimony and that he couldn't testify before you in person.
Well, I, as did other members of the committee, apologized on behalf of the American people for the disgusting treatment to which our government, I believe, knowingly subjected him. The fact that he couldn't testify in front of our committee is completely unjustified because the government, despite no compelling evidence for it, that keeps him on a terrorist list, on a no-fly list, won't let him enter the country, even to testify at our request, because we had requested that he be let into the country to testify in our subcommittee, before our subcommittee, and that was refused. I believe that what happened here was that the United States government consciously and deliberately conspired with the government of Syria to have him tortured. That's why he was rendered to Syria. This was not a case of expedited removal, as the Attorney General, I believe, untruthfully testified to our subcommittee. I think this violates the criminal statute against torture. The only reason to send him to Syria was to have him tortured. The fact that we sought assurances, diplomatic assurances, from a country that's on the State Department terrorist list and that's been on the list for 10 years of countries that routinely practice torture is obviously a joke.
There are believed to be thousands of cases of the U.S. engaging in this extraordinary term, extraordinary rendition, which many just say is White House for kidnapping. How is Congress, now run by Democrats, dealing with this? How do you get at this issue?
Well, it's very difficult to get at the issue when the Justice Department won't prosecute cases. We're holding hearings and investigating to bring some of these facts to light. It's already, we can't make it a criminal act because it's already a criminal act. So I'm not, besides bringing this to light and referring this to the Justice Department for prosecution, I'm not sure what we can do.
You're calling for the U.S. to apologize to Maher Arar?
Oh, absolutely. The U.S. should apologize to him. The U.S. should compensate him. The Canadian government voted $10.5 million compensation for their role in it. We should probably do at least that, perhaps a lot more, because our role was a lot worse than their role. And I believe some of the officials who were involved in this should be held to account.
It was Stephen Harper, the Bush ally, the Prime Minister of Canada, who announced the $10 million the Canadian government was giving to Maher Arar. And it's interesting to see a Bush ally castigate the Bush administration over this issue, over sending him to a country that President Bush himself said walks down the road of terrorism.
Well, and the State Department annual human rights report says that they not only practice, says that they routinely torture people. So we had every reason to expect that he would be tortured if he were given to them under circumstances that suggested to him that that the United States government suspected him of being a terrorist. Notice what happened here. He didn't try to enter the United States. The expedited removal statutes is designed to stop people from coming into the United States who don't have proper documents and to give us an expedited way. I oppose its enactment, but it's supposed to give us an expedited way without going before an immigration judge or preventing someone who's illegal from entering the United States in the first place. That is, whose presence in the United States would be illegal. But he wasn't seeking to enter the United States. He was changing planes at Kennedy on a flight from Europe to Canada. If we suspected him of something, we should simply have sent him on to Canada, which is a foreign country. He wasn't seeking to enter the United States. Instead, we chose to send him to Syria, where he had been born and we had lived until he was a teenager, but otherwise had no connections with them. And the only obvious reason to do that is to have him tortured.
What about the companies that are involved with extraordinary rendition? For example, there's this other case of Khaled Masri, the German citizen who was the victim of extraordinary rendition. Aero Contractors has been closely involved, connected to the CIA's rendition program, and was involved with El-Masri's torture and kidnapping. Germany recently issued arrest warrants for at least three of Aero Contractors involved in his case. It's based, I believe, in North Carolina.
Well, a company that only did this in Germany would be subject to German law, not to American law. They did nothing illegal in the United States, I would assume. But they would certainly be subject to German law, which, I mean, this would be kidnapping. I assume it's a serious offense. It ought to be in Germany. And, of course, if the United States is snatching someone off the streets of a foreign country and sending them to a third country to be tortured or, for that matter, not to be tortured, that's frankly kidnapping. And most countries have laws against kidnapping. And, in fact, arrest warrants have been issued in both Italy and Germany against CIA agents who conspired in this. And I think it's very wrong for the United States to be ordering employees of the United States, that is CIA agents, to violate the laws of friendly countries and to subject them to prosecution.
Congressmember Nadler, I wanted to switch gears and ask you about Tanner, the chief of the voting rights section of the Department of Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department, who admitted earlier this month that elderly voters might be disenfranchised by new restrictive voter ID laws. John Tanner made the comment at the National Latino Congress. Tanner went on to say white elderly voters would be harmed most by the voter ID laws because most minorities die before becoming elderly.
Of course, that also ties in to the racial aspect because our society is such that minorities don't become elderly the way white people do. They die first. There are inequities in health care. There are a variety of inequities in this country. And so anything that disproportionately impacts the elderly has the opposite impact on minorities. Just the math is such as that.
This was videotaped and shown on Brad blog. The comments prompted a letter from Barack Obama to the acting attorney general calling for Tanner's immediate dismissal. You were asking questions about him before he was even elevated to head the Civil Rights Division. What are you calling for now?
Well, he should certainly be fired, obviously. Obviously, someone who has such prejudices has no business heading the voting rights section or any other branch of the government, or and certainly not being on the federal voting commission, which is supposed to enforce our election laws and our voting rights laws. Now, Mr. Tanner, as head of the voting rights section, perverted the Justice Department, or he and a few others, perverted the Justice Department from seeking to protect people's civil rights and the right to vote to seeking deliberately, I believe, and I think a number of reports have shown this, to use the Justice Department to disenfranchise people likely to vote Democratic, specifically minorities and more elderly people. Now, here he's admitting that procedures that he sought to put into place would discriminate against elderly people in voting, would cause valid elderly voters not to be able to vote. That's against the law. And it's obviously also should be against the policy of the United States government. But we know that the Bush administration has been using these voter ID cards, the fear of so far never demonstrated voter fraud, to put into place all sorts of new restrictions, voter ID cards, purge lists and so forth, which we know have the effect of disproportionately disenfranchising legal elderly and minority but likely to vote Democratic voters.
I also wanted to ask you about another appointment that you've been involved with contesting. You, along with other Congress members like California's Henry Waxman, wrote a letter to the Health and Human Services Secretary Michael Levitt, urging him to reconsider the appointment of Susan Orr to head the Office of Family Planning. What is your concern?
Well, Susan Orr was an official, I believe, of the Family Research Council, if memory serves. But more to the point, she has repeatedly expressed the opinion that contraception is wrong and evil and that we shouldn't be engaged in it, that the government shouldn't be engaged in promoting the use of contraceptives. Now, the appointment to which the position to which she's been appointed is as head of an agency of the government whose prime function is to promote the proper use of contraceptives in order to prevent unwanted pregnancies. So obviously someone who does not believe in the mission of the agency, who thinks that if the agency does its job is doing something wrong, is not qualified to be the head of that agency. Now, of course, we have seen the Bush administration repeatedly appoint people to all sorts of regulatory agencies who obviously do not, and by their own admission, do not believe in the functions and purposes of those agencies. And such appointments, including this one, are obviously made to sabotage, either to sabotage the work of the agency or just to give a political plum to some right-wing organization that the administration wants to make happy.
Finally, Congressman Nadler, on another issue, on the issue of the Gina 6, and you were a part of the hearing on this case where the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Louisiana, Donald Washington, testified. He had done a report on what happened in Gina, the six kids who were originally charged with attempted second-degree murder for a schoolyard fight. And he had done a report saying that the nooses that were hung from a schoolyard tree when the black students tried to sit down under that tree at Gina High School were not a hate crime. What is your assessment of this case and where it's going? Michael Bell, one of the six, has now been put back in jail.
Well, this case is a case where the local authorities, the local DA in particular, district attorney in particular, these were in one way unconnected. I mean, you had the bias, what I would call the bias crime of the nooses being hung under the tree, and a few months later you have this by a bunch of white kids, and a few months later you have this white kid beaten up by a bunch of black kids. Now, what was notable, what made this a major a case, is that on the one hand, the local authorities do essentially nothing. I think the kids who hung the nooses were suspended from school for a day or two. On the other hand, the black kids who are involved in or allegedly involved in this are charged with serious crimes, initially attempted murder, when their only weapon with an attempted murder there has to be with a weapon, and here they're saying the weapons were their hands, which is not the way they normally do things in Louisiana.
I think it was their sneakers.
Sneakers. All right. They didn't come there with objects designed to be weapons, which is the intent of the statute. So the point is they were very clearly throwing the book and then some at the black kids, but doing virtually nothing, letting off with a slap on the wrist the white kids. And it's just disparate treatment and an example. Instead of trying to calm racial tensions, they're acting in every way to inflame racial tensions and to help the white bigots. And this was a case, and that obviously shouldn't be. And the first thing that we had to do and other people had to do was to say, wait a minute, you can't charge a bunch of juveniles with attempted murder for what amounts to a rather severe schoolyard fight, number one. And that was eventually taken care of. But they're still really throwing the book at these kids, and they're not doing anything commensurate on the other side. Now, the U.S. attorney could have stepped in, and he could have said, hey, wait a minute. He could have used, if nothing else, the power of his voice to say, this is a very disproportionate use of state power. It's probably a racist use of state power. And he could have had a large impact in stopping it. Instead, he did nothing.
Will you be calling the LaSalle Parish District Attorney, Reed Walters, to testify, the one who, after the nooses were hung and the kids protested under the tree, came with police and said to the kids, I can wipe out your lives with a stroke of a pen?
We are considering that. I cannot say yet whether we will or not.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. New York Congressmember Gerald Nadler speaking to us from the Capitol Rotunda. When we come back, we'll be joined by a Kurdish human rights activist. Stay with us. song Kurdish Heritage by Ramji and Bashir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Turkish warplanes and ground troops have attacked Kurdish militant positions just inside northern Iraq over the last 3 days, killing 34 members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK. A Turkish military source told Reuters some 300 ground troops have advanced about 6 miles into Iraqi territory in cross-border raids. Turkey's been threatening to invade northern Iraq for days, and tensions remain high following the killing of as many as 17 Turkish soldiers by the PKK over the weekend. Meanwhile, the buildup of troops along the Turkish-Iraqi border continues, with military helicopters airlifting commando units into the area overnight. Kurdish fighters with the PKK have offered a ceasefire if Turkey abandons plans to launch cross-border raids, but Turkey has refused to negotiate with PKK, which it considers a terrorist group. Karim Yildiz is the co-founder and executive director of the London-based Kurdish Human Rights Project. He was an Amnesty International prisoner of conscience and fled political persecution in Turkey in 1986. He was granted asylum in Britain. His group contributed to important reforms in Turkey and has also brought several cases before the European Court of Human Rights. Karim Yildiz has written extensively about Kurdish issues. His latest books, The Kurds in Iraq, The Past, Present, and Future, and The Kurds in Syria, A Forgotten People. He joins us now in a Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about what is happening on the border, the significance of it? Who is the PKK, the group that the U.S. and Turkey call terrorist group?
The PKK, Kurdish Workers' Party, has been in conflict with the Turkish state since 1984. Since then, there were policy developed by the Turkish state to empty almost 3,000 villages and hamlets in Turkey, evacuated all those people forcibly. And this conflict brings right now at least 3 million IDP in Turkey. And the recent the incident is not new, is not a unique incident. The same kind of incidents is happening like last 15 years. During this conflict, almost 30,000 people were killed in both sides by the Turkish military side and by the Kurdish side. So in that sense, I think what Turkey is doing right now is threatening the stability in the Kurdish region of Iraq at the moment. That is the point.
Al Jazeera English aired an exclusive interview on Tuesday with Masroor Barzani, the chief of intelligence and security in Iraqi Kurdistan. This is how Barzani explained the responsibility of the Kurdistan Regional Government, or the KRG, for attacks by Kurdish militants against Turkey.
We are not a part of this problem. PKK existed long before the KRG was established. So this is not something that the KRG is responsible for. And we are not going to be a part of this, and we will not allow anybody to drag us into this internal problem. And we hope that Turkey also doesn't export its own problems into our region. But if we, for any reason, become the target, and if the KRG is the target of a bigger, let's say, operation, then we will do everything we can to defend ourselves.
Karim Yildiz, your response.
Well, I think it is important to know, in our view, is the Turkish government has carried out such kind of military operations at least 20, 30, 40 times last 10 years and did not receive any response. I mean, the question is not the PKK. The question is about the rights of the Kurdish people. The rights of the Kurdish people right now in Turkey is constitutionally denied. The Turkey still has the policy of denial toward the Kurdish people. I mean, give you an example. The Kurds are still not allowed to use their mother tongue in everyday life, in their politics.
Kurdish.
The Kurdish people. So they have to speak in Turkish. I mean,
this was why Lemizana, who spoke in Kurdish before the Turkish parliament, she was a parliamentarian, was imprisoned.
That's precisely. I mean, you know, because she spoke in Kurdish, and she's been imprisoned with her colleagues over 10 years. And right now, there are pro-Kurdish parties member in the Turkish parliament. The public prosecutor brought a case against them because they were speaking Kurdish during the military, during the election campaign. I mean, the questions is actually directly related to the military incursion in Iraq, is directly related to the development of the Kurdistan-Iraq and in related to the oil issues related to the Kirkuk referendum is not issues of the PKK.
You think this is about oil?
It is about oil, is about the development in Kurdistan, Iraq, because Turkey is right now is collaborating with the most repressive regime like Iran and like Syria, despite they are trying to become a member of the European Union. The reason they're doing that, they do not want to see any development in relation to the Kurdish self-determination
in
Iraq.
Do you think Turkey wants to take over Kurdistan?
Well, what I think is Turkey do not want to see the Kurds have either federalism, federal state, or autonomy in Iraq or any part of the Kurdistan. That's why they are working together with Iran and Syria.
I interviewed historian and blogger Juan Cole Monday. I asked him about the significance of the PKK killing 17 Turkish troops over the weekend. I want to play an excerpt of what he had to say.
Imagine what would happen in this country if a guerrilla group based in a neighboring country came over the border and killed 17 U.S. troops. That would be a war. The Kurdish guerrilla movement, the Kurdish Workers Party, based in now in Iraq, but originally from eastern Anatolia, from the Turkish regions, is conducting a guerrilla war against the Turkish military. It is being given safe harbor by the Kurdish politicians on the Iraqi side. And in essence, the United States has created this situation in which a NATO ally, people forget, Turkey fought alongside the United States in Korea. It's got troops in Afghanistan. A NATO ally of the United States is being attacked and its troops killed by a terrorist organization, so designated by the State Department, that it essentially has U.S. auspices. The U.S. Is responsible for security in Iraq.
That's one call. Karim Yildiz, your response.
Well, first of all, we have to understand this issue is there are armed conflict in Turkey between the PKK and the Turkish state. And this is not first armed conflict. And the armed conflict took 29 armed conflict took place last 70 years just since the establishment of the Republic of Turkey. I mean, the question is all about the rights of the Kurdish people in Turkey, and it's question about democracy, freedom of expression, freedom of media in Turkey. It is not correct to say Turkey is member of the NATO, Turkey member of the other international community. It is correct to say they are a member of this international institution. They have obligations. And those institutions has also obligation actually to ask Turkey to act with responsibility.
We only have 15 seconds, but how does the U.S. close relationship with Turkey, sending hundreds of million dollars of weapons to Turkey, affect the Kurds? What do you think people in the U.S. can do? 10 seconds.
Well, the money has been sent to Turkey and used in the army, and this army has used this money to kill the Kurds, to evacuate their villages, and to violate the rights of the Kurds. Therefore, the United States Department and the United States people must observe what actually happened on the ground, how their money has been used.
We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Karim Yıldız, for joining us, Kurdish human rights activist who's currently based in Britain. Thanks for joining us in New York. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokadus, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.